When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 8, The Potions Master.
Oh, so omnibus. Yeah, so I feel like I found this to be an interesting chapter on the whole, because so far as the story has unfolded for our first seven chapters, I feel like they are all just remarkably heavy with like brand new information, lots of like hard hitting stuff. But I feel like this is sort of like you're sort of in that like mid-season, like it's not exactly a filler episode, like important stuff.
Oh, absolutely happens. Important stuff. There's a lot of like tiny, not necessarily like foreshadowing stuff, just sort of stuff that when you read it again the next time, you're like, oh, this was kind of like an you can like, it feels like it was established earlier, but you couldn't have like connected it or predicted it or something.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I know exactly what you're talking about. So anyway, yeah, the Potions Master really is going to be a chapter that revolves around Harry's first week at Hogwarts.
Yeah.
It gives us an introduction to many of the classes that he is going to be taking on the annual basis.
This is the real trick, is that chapters like this, like there are often sections of the story that will do exactly what this chapter does, where it's like, here were the proceedings at Hogwarts, things were changing, important plot device disguised as expositional things happening in the castle. Like it feels like, you're right, it is designed to feel like a filler chapter so that you miss the important things.
Yeah. So I do think there's a lot to unlock in here in terms of some really, really fun details. But right away, we sort of get like the introduction, you know, where like the chapter starts with minimal context other than just there, look, where? Next to the tall kid with the red hair, wearing the glasses. Did you see his face? Did you see his scar? So it's just sort of like marking almost immediately how recognizable Harry's going to be inside of, you know, the wizarding world at school. You know, all of his fellow classmates, you know, have heard the tale. They know who he is. It's remarkable that he's there. So you start to get like a feel for the additional pressure Harry will always have on himself as he moves forward as a student. Like he's, no matter what, I mean, he's living a rather unique existence, but his, even compared to other students, is that much more unique.
Absolutely. It's established right away. And then you start hearing about the castle itself, how there's 142 staircases, just a real popular trivia question. Remember that one, 142 staircases at Hogwarts.
Yeah, this is one of those where I remember once upon a time when I was losing so horrendously in the Jay versus Ben episodes, I remember like I was like, I'm going to read through, I'm going to start making notes, I'm going to have like mnemonic devices and different ways to to remember details. And my really ridiculous one is that I remember in elementary school, kids would say 143 or 143 meant I love you, because it was like one for I, four for love, and then three for you. So 143 meant like,
I love you. Like the number of letters in each thing.
Yes.
Why would that mean that?
I know. Literally, I had to remember why it worked.
Okay.
Because I was like, I know at one point in time I knew how this was a thing, but I can't remember why it is now a thing. But so literally my ridiculous device for remembering the staircases is it's 143 minus one.
There you go. Yeah. It's like I love you minus one.
I have mild attachment. Not like I have some reason why I can remember the number 143, and that just helps me then backpedal into 142.
Yeah. The weird thing is whenever this question comes up, the number I always think of is 143.
Okay.
Instead of 142. Right. I don't know why. It just seems like a more memorable number or something.
Maybe it's the I love you thing.
Maybe it's the I love you thing. I didn't know about that until 10 seconds ago, but maybe deep in my memory I did.
Can I just say one of the things I found interesting about this is that when it's talking about like all the different staircases, it says there are wide ones, sweeping ones, narrow, rickety ones, some that led somewhere different on a Friday, some with a vanishing step halfway up that you had to remember to jump. So there's a little bit of this, like some that led to somewhere different on a Friday, but there is no actual words that say that the staircases themselves move. And this is like one of those things that like the movie introduces, and like as soon as they like enter like the grand, hallways or whatever, you know, like you look up and they're all moving like back and forth. But that's actually more of like a movie invention, and I don't think it's ever brought up again until like Half-Blood Prince.
Really?
Yeah, there's not like a really specific line that suggests that like they were on a staircase that like physically moved and then like, you know, prevented them from getting to where they were supposed to go.
That's interesting, because it does say that like it felt like things are moving around a lot. It was also hard to remember where anything was because it all seemed to move around a lot.
Yeah.
So it says that right after it describes the kind of stairs there are, and it describes a bunch of different kinds of stairs and the way that like maybe they lead different places, but that could be because the landing changes, not because the stair moved.
Right. Yeah. Like it's hard to know.
That's interesting.
I know. I thought that was interesting as well. Because, I mean, the moving staircases is just something that's like in my head canon for the Wizarding World.
Yeah. And I think it is canon now, because it's like, it's canon that Rowena Ravenclaw is the one who introduced the moving staircases, right?
Yeah. I believe that is correct. Yeah. From her chocolate frog card. I think that is like a detail that is known. Moving just ever so slightly forward, you also get like doors that wouldn't open unless you asked politely or tickled them in exactly the right place.
Never tickle a sleeping dragon, Ben.
Yeah, we made the video, guys.
We made the video. It's out there. Because we actually, I think that video came out before the episode in which we discovered it in the podcast came out.
Yes. Yeah, so we recorded the episode where we were like, did Hogwarts used to be a dragon? Going back to the Caput Draconis being the head of the dragon, the Gryffindor common room, like physically possibly being in that position. But the tickling is certainly very interesting. We delved into it a lot. Honestly, the never tickle a sleeping dragon, I felt like ended up being like the really big, like just like, oh my gosh, like that's such a ridiculous motto for the school to have. And it never really comes up at all. And it's just like, because the school's a dragon.
Because the school's a dragon. It's just like you're thinking it too metaphorically. It's literally
a dragon.
A dragon.
An actual dragon.
Yeah. Speaking of which, oh, sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, just on that tickling front, we do know eventually we will learn that the kitchens are hidden behind a portrait where if you tickle the pear, you do gain access. So even though we know that Harry doesn't learn that until what? When do we meet Winky? Fourth year,
yeah.
Yeah. So we know that it's a while before we'll learn that, but that is one of those. We know that continues to be like a canon detail, like something that is revisited.
Yep. There's also, it says, I like this just tiny inclusion where it's just Harry was sure the coats of armor could walk, and I just wrote like, indeed. Yep. It's just like this like very little thing that's like, oh boy, can they walk.
Yes.
Oh boy, that's a very intentional detail right there.
Yes, they can quite literally defend the castle.
They can come to life and fight, which is super fun. One of the things that's always like, it's like you don't think about it because you're like, yeah, you're at a castle, but like he wouldn't believe they were lost. Filch catches them doing something. He said he wouldn't believe they were lost. They were sure they were trying to break into it on purpose and was threatening to lock them in the dungeons when they were rescued by Professor Quirrell, who was passing. So, boy, a couple things about that sentence. First of all, it is so sneaky the way this is done. Yes. First of all, though, why, like, you don't think about it because they're in a castle and you're like, oh yeah, castles have dungeons, but like, it's a school. Like, why are there dungeons at all? There should be no dungeons.
There should be no dungeons. Unless dungeons are just like basements.
I mean, you know? I thought that. I was like, maybe this is the case. But I looked up the word dungeon, and it just means like secure prison cell, especially in a castle.
Wow.
So it's like there's not like mistaking it. You know, it's not like basement is just another word. Like dungeon means dungeon. I mean, that's what Filch is doing. He's threatening to lock them in the dungeons.
Okay, so here's my thoughts on this. Because I think I've thought this before, like going back to the late 9th century when the founders would have been basically in 10th century, I guess, founding the school of Hogwarts. Like I think there's a lot to be said for what is actually going on during this time in like actual real world history and like the perception of magic and witches and the way that people like this were being treated during those periods of time. You know, because this was obviously, you know, throughout history, even though, you know, magic and stuff, as far as we know, just isn't real in the capacity that we're reading about it. It's not like people have not been punished for such things in the past. So part of me almost thinks that, like, if you were to really delve again into that Founder series and get a feel for what the Founders were trying to accomplish with the Castle of Hogwarts, it almost occurs to me that there's some outside possibility that it wasn't solely intended to be just a school, but also like a multifunctional.
Yeah, like as a castle, was it more of like a genuine fortress or something, like a line of defense?
Yeah, because, and we also know that Hogsmeade, the town that literally exists right next to Hogwarts, I think is the only known, at least in England, the only exclusively wizarding population.
Right.
Like, so even Godric's Hollow has muggles. Like,
yeah. So was this like a place for the town to retreat to in case of attack or something?
Almost certainly is sort of what my mind would say. So like, I almost feel like what the Founders were really attempting to do was provide safe haven for the wizarding world. And then once that was sort of happening, and once there was a place for people to potentially go, it was like, we can also like be teaching people while we're here. And like that way, if they have control of their magic, then it's altogether less dangerous, you know, like
teach
a code of conduct.
Right.
So, you know, I certainly think, because the Statute of Secrecy won't be created for centuries.
Yeah.
I think it's not until like the 1600s or 1700s when that's put into place.
Right.
I can't remember the specific detail, but either way, I mean, it means that there's a good possibility, especially being so remote, that they were just quite literally trying to provide a place for people to go and hide.
Yeah, that's what it seems to me. I mean, the fact that they have dungeons means that they at one point were used for housing prisoners. So the castle must have served that function at some point.
But it's certainly not for students.
Certainly not for students, yeah. Filch.
The poltergeist.
The other interesting thing about that exact sentence is that it says, like, it's such a tricky sentence, because Filch is getting Harry and them in trouble for accidentally trying to get through the entrance of the Out of Bounds corridor where Fluffy is. They don't know that yet, but they're rescued by Professor Quirrell, who is passing by. And it's like, you think, oh, he rescued them, that's great. And it's like, no. He's investigating
yes.
the spot. Like, that's why he's there. And it's like, it paints him as a good guy, but it's like a small detail that, like, no, he's the bad guy.
It's like, that's why Quirrell is there.
Yeah, that's why Quirrell was there.
It's like, it's not convenient timing. And like, if anything, like, Quirrell probably, like, I imagine if you were to see the whole scene through his lens, what you would witness is him almost having a sense of feeling caught himself.
Yeah.
And then being like, oh no, Filch, these kids are fine. Like,
yeah.
You know, like realizing in the moment, like, wait, no, I have the authority here. Like,
right,
you know,
exactly.
Like, I'm a teacher. Like, as far as anybody else knows, I'm just a teacher. I'm allowed to be here.
Right.
But yeah, so again, I know that we talked a little bit about it in the last chapter, but I feel like you are getting a really significant contrast here between the two paragraphs adjoining. So basically you get one big paragraph about Peeves and what happens if you run into Peeves, and then you get a big paragraph about Filch and what happens if you run into Filch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I mean, these two are the antithesis of one another. Like, they are exact equal opposites of one another. Like,
I mean, even the length of paragraph looks the exact same.
It really does. Like,
yeah.
This is, I mean, I don't want to harp on it for too long, because I know we talk about it all the time, but it really has just always been one of my favorite theories. And I feel like I would love for this one to just be properly confirmed. Like, it seems so harmless otherwise. It doesn't change anything about the story.
No, it's just a poltergeist. It just sort of explains at least the connection between him and Mrs. Norris. There's like something magical.
Yes, almost certainly.
Yep.
Not to mention, Filch also knows all the secret passageways, which we learn about. You know, it does mm-hmm. it does say,
because he's part of the castle.
Exactly.
Yep.
He knows it better than anyone except for maybe the Weasley twins.
Map foreshadowing right there.
Yep. So it's kind of like a little bit of a nod to the fact that the Weasleys are already like one step ahead.
Oh my gosh. There's so many nods to Fred and George being like such troublemakers and such so knowledgeable about the castle. Like, even in just like this chapter alone, I think I wrote it down later on, like, there's so many nods to them.
Well, that's the thing. Like, this is where I've always said, like, you know, people ask a lot, like, you know, what could the new like HBO series or something do to provide something new to the story overall? And I always come back to Fred and George. Like, you can't really tell, like, it's not like you need like the story as told by Ron, the story as told by Hermione, because like they're just so adjacent to Harry all the time that they're effectively part of the main story always.
Yeah.
So it's like, who then becomes like your secondary characters whose tale you want to follow? And I just love Fred and George. They're like two of my favorite like Harry Potter characters of all time.
They're fantastic. I mean, I think, another scene. I could almost see like Harry goes to bed after the first night, wakes up the next day, and you see him pushing on the door with Fluffy. Filch walks up and is like, "Hey, get out of here," or whatever.
Nice, Filch. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you. And then you see Quirrell show up. And then like later in the season, as he's like explaining it to Harry, you can see like the flashback where like what really happened.
Oh, yes.
Kind of thing, you know. Yep. That's the sort of thing I think would be interesting. I think there's an interesting sentence here that says, "There was a lot more to magic, as Harry's quickly found out, than waving your wand and saying a few funny words." And it's like, that's true, but also a lot of times that is all it is.
You know, we talk about the magic systems sometimes that are used in different fantasy novels, and it's really fascinating because I actually had never caught this before, but on this particular pass-through, I was like, wait a second, this stands out to me all of a sudden. So in the world of Harry Potter, it always feels like we're dealing with what is largely regarded as a soft magic system, which largely is sort of like this big question of like, what physical toll does it ultimately take on the witch or wizard to cast a spell? Like, if you were in a duel and you're just blasting spells back and forth, are you exhausted from that? Does it like sap a certain kind of like inner like mana energy that like, you know, that like fuels your magic as time goes on? Do you have like a recharge period or anything?
Right.
Or can you just continuously, you know, cast? And it seems like for the most part, like the incantation is sort of like a way to direct your efforts and sort of like associate the intended magic with an otherwise movement, because we know the incantation itself is not necessary because there is nonverbal magic.
Right.
You know, so that's a certain piece of it. You've also got the fact that you can channel your magic through any object, but like wands are most adept at doing so. Mm-hmm. So it means like you could technically pick up like a piece of chalk and probably like make something come from the piece of chalk.
Well, because you don't even need a wand, you know, like Harry's doing magic, you know, he makes the glass disappear at the zoo.
Right.
Wandless magic is a thing too.
Yeah. And when you learn about like, you know, wizards in North America, you'll learn that like, you know, the like, you know, native people to the area were basically just doing wandless magic.
Like, yeah. Like they didn't have wands.
Like that was just their specialty. Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I found to be particularly interesting is because the story that we always like to really compare the magic system to of Harry Potter is our other favorite, you know, fantasy series, which was called Name of the Wind or the Kingkiller Chronicles. And they use a type of magic called sympathy, which basically goes into a whole bunch of different things. But it's basically like physics-based magic, essentially.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's really fascinating is that in the very next page, we learned that in their first transfiguration class, McGonagall tasks them with changing a match into a needle.
Yep.
And there's actually a little bit of a sympathetic link going on, I feel like, there, because you quite literally have two objects that are like similar in size and stature,
yeah,
which should make the conversion like a little bit more simple in the scheme of things. So like for this to be the starting point, to use two objects that are so similar suggests on some level that like that similarity aids in the ease of conversion.
It seems like it almost lends itself to like even the possibility of it. Like, I don't think you could turn like a matchstick into like a pig.
Well,
you know.
I mean, we see her in this change a desk into a pig.
Oh, I know, but a desk is more pig-shaped to begin with.
That's true. Like, it has it has four legs.
Right.
That's a good point.
It is, like, the appropriate size. Maybe you could turn a matchstick into, like, a really tiny pig.
Right. Well, one of the other details I was looking into, because I was trying to feel, like, the different things that they do in class, and, like, at one point in time, they convert, like, pin cushions into, like, little hedgehogs or porcupines, which is, like, again, you know, like, those are fairly similar.
Yeah.
But the other one that I found fascinating is that eventually they'll do guinea pigs into guinea fowl. And guinea pigs are like a small,
little bit bigger hamster.
Yeah, like a little rodent type thing. And a guinea fowl is closer to like a chicken. And so what's interesting about that is it's actually the name is the same. So you have guinea and guinea. So there's a little bit of that sympathetic link going on, even though it's only in the proper name for the item. So anyway, I found that to be just kind of
magic cares about puns.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, for sure.
Take some into consideration. It's quirky like that.
Okay, so you keep going through his classes here. I thought it was interesting that like so he's going through all the different classes he has, or like it's introducing you to the number of different people in the castle and stuff. But I think it's so funny that like you always think of how Hogwarts is this like constantly happy, magical place, but like, if you're going through this, like, Professor Binns is super boring. Peeves, terrible. Filch, terrible. Snape, mean. McGonagall, hard. It's like, all the classes seem like, it seems kind of rough.
Even Sprout is described. Yeah. And I was like, poor Sprout. The description of her, the first one we ever get is dumpy little witch.
Right.
Which I was like, that feels like an insult level you choose. I was like, poor. I mean, Sprout. Look, I tell you what, I'm here for you. Okay, just so you know. Okay. Yeah, you are correct. I mean, it says. I mean, even when you get to, did you say Quarles class, which you know everybody was super excited about, and it turned out to be a bit of a joke.
Bit of a joke. It's like, okay, what are we learning anything?
Anything at all? Are we anything actually at all? Being educated in this system here?
Okay. Also, this is just like a little Easter egg, or not even Easter egg, but like in Professor Bin's class, it says the students are confusing Emmerich the Evil and Uruk the Oddball,
yeah,
which has to just be based on the fact that their names sound similar, because like what they're each famous for is like wildly different.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Yeah. So first of all, Emmerich the Evil goes on to, he does get mentioned again as a former master of the Elder Wand, or at least wielder. I don't know about master.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
yeah.
That's
yeah.
one. Like, I think Xenophilius mentions him later on as well. So that's sort of there.
What a throwback.
He was killed by Egbert the Egregious in gruesome fashion.
Ah, sure.
Which, you know, again, if you had the Elder Wand and was truly master of it, the Elder Wand sucks at winning duels. Like it does not do what it says on the box.
Well, I just think the legend is mistaken.
It's just wrong.
I mean, yeah. The whole, I mean, we could probably do just an entire episode about nothing but the Elder Wand.
I mean, we've made like 10 videos about nothing but the Elder Wand on the main channel.
And I still don't even know exactly where I stand on
it. I think our most recent pass at it, that you need to be worthy to be like a true like anyone can hold it and do magic, and it is better at like, you know, choosing or like working for anyone than like say like Ron's hand-me-down wand.
Than
most wands, but like the thing that makes it appear to constantly be powerful is that powerful people think it's powerful, so they seek it out. And then because they are powerful, they do things with it.
Yes.
It's like what Ollivander says, like, you know, terrible, yes, but great.
Right,
it's
right,
like,
right.
This is the nature of the Elder Wand. It is constantly terrible but great people, and so it gets this reputation as being good. But as far as I'm concerned, the only two people to ever have genuinely been masters of the Elder Wand that we are aware of are Dumbledore and Harry, because they're the only two people who we ever see genuinely perform
extraordinary
magic. And that piece of magic is the same for both of them, and it is repairing a wand. Dumbledore repairs Hagrid's, whereas Harry repairs his own, which Ollivander says shouldn't be possible. And Ollivander, you think you can trust to know, since his family's been doing it for over 1,200 years or something.
Yeah, it's just been forever and a half. Absolutely agree.
They're both, it's like Mjolnir.
So did you end up telling me who Uruk the Oddball?
Uruk the Oddball is an appropriately named, super odd guy. He used to wear a jellyfish as a hat.
Cool.
And he would sleep with 50 auguries in the room with him.
50?
50. And of course, the auguries have this like bad reputation of like predicting death.
Yeah,
but what they actually predict is oncoming rain. But he slept with 50 of them, and there was a big storm coming, so they're all going crazy. He woke up and assumed, because they were all yelling so loudly, that he must be dead and was a ghost, and gave himself a concussion trying to walk through walls, which he couldn't because he wasn't dead. Yeah, but he was in Ravenclaw and was possibly taught by Rowena herself.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure why he's confused with Emmerich, because they're not really the same in that way at all.
Yeah, but this is like one of those things where it's like, what is coming down to that, like, Binns is just this inefficient at teaching?
Oh, why? This is another one. It's like, why does Dumbledore let Professor Binns continue to be the teacher? Like, it's just such a bad staffing choice. Like, all of the students are bored.
Yes, you know? like to problematic degrees.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, I mean, and it's interesting too, you know, it's like Dumbledore is always kind of odd with who he elects to hire for all the positions. Like, even going through all this, I mean, like, McGonagall is, I mean, Flitwick never really has anything negative super attached to him at all, but, you know, McGonagall feels like she's probably like the most effective teacher. Snape seems like he just simply scares everyone.
I mean, anytime I feel like you see Snape teaching, it's just like, I wrote the instructions on the chalkboard, do it. I'll be here doing no instruction at all.
Yeah, that's not incredibly helpful. You know,
yeah, even when Slughorn's there, he's like, ooh, I suppose you added some peppermint to counteract the whatever. It's like, that's a useful tip.
Right.
It's like Snape's not passing out peppermint tips.
That's the thing, too, is like, we know that Snape is the Half-Blood Prince. We know that he has all these tips that he's written in like the ledgers of his books. It's like, why is he not literally teaching all of his students exactly these things?
I know!
This is like one of those things where it's like, it's almost like a vanity issue where it's like, you know, the teacher becomes the master. No, the student becomes the master. I got that right that second time. Where it's almost like, was Snape just like having like a pride related issue when he was just like worried that one of his students would become better than him at his own craft?
Right. He's like, I know all the secrets and I'm a teacher. I'm not going to tell you the secrets because I earned those myself by figuring them out. That's not for you to know.
I know. That's like, it's yeah. like, no, this is the exact, this is why the student becomes the master, because they have the benefit of all of the teaching.
Right. Yeah. Like you are like actively withholding information from your student. You're being a bad teacher on purpose, it feels like.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, more on Snape in just a second. Cause there was another
the chapter is called The Potions Master.
I know. Yeah. So we'll definitely spend some more time on him. But I wanted to just touch on a little detail. So we get into Quirrell's room, which, you know, this we're doing DADA, which we know eventually will go on to be Harry's like most prominent class, although not for any help from his first 2 years of education in the subject. He basically learns in years 3, 4, and I guess in 6.
I guess Snape is teaching him then. But
1, 2, and 5. So like of his 6 years at school, Harry the high school dropout has 3 actual years of education in Defense Against the Dark Arts, and is apparently like the best ever at it. So I don't know how to explain that. But one of the things I thought was just kind of funny, or I was like, I wonder if this is supposed to be a nod, but he says his turban, he told them, had been given to him by an African prince as a thank you for getting rid of a troublesome zombie. I have literally no idea if this is intended to be like a little bit of like a spoof on like the classic like Nigerian prince email scam that popped up, you know, because during like, I think like the late 90s, early 2000s, it was just like a really common like trope of a scam that would happen. It was essentially like a wealthy African prince essentially would reach out to you and say like, hey, I'm on hard times, but if you can help me like through this difficult, you know, peace or whatever, then I will like reward you beyond your wildest dreams or something. And people were like, oh, I mean, it's a prince reaching out for help. Like, of course I'll help.
Of course.
But like, obviously like even the class is like, it says literally the next sentence, but they weren't sure they believed this story. And it's like, even that feels like it like falls in line. Like, you know, if you're just like an everyday household United States resident, why would a Nigerian prince be reaching out to you in particular?
Right.
Like, it's like, you know, like you should be skeptical of that story, basically, is what it comes down to. And so I don't know whether or not it's supposed to be a nod at all, but I had never caught that before. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that's like a joke or anything there.
Well, it's almost certainly not true, because we know the real reason he wears the turban is to conceal Voldemort in, you know, on the back of his head. What's interesting is that I think it's like when you meet Quirrell in the movies, he's immediately wearing the turban, but it sounds like maybe he wasn't wearing the turban until term started.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, so like when Harry meets him in the Leaky Cauldron, he's not wearing the turban the first time.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that's because, like, so again, I think we've talked about that a little bit, but it's like, you know, Harry reaches out and is able to shake Quirrell's hand at the Leaky Cauldron without, you know, it being impactful.
Without hurting him.
So that must mean that Voldemort has not yet taken up residence in the back of Quirrell's head.
Yeah,
yet,
but
so.
Now he has.
Now he has. Yeah, for now sure. He's there.
Which also, there's a nod to that as well, where it says a funny smell hung around the turban. That's just Voldemort.
Yeah. It's like, is this to suggest that Voldemort smells bad?
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of like during COVID times, when you have to wear a mask all day, and it's like, you know, you're just sort of breathing into the mask all day. Like, the mask doesn't smell great by the end of the day.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Okay, got you.
And he's just back there just, like, breathing in his own bad breath all day.
that is just a ridiculous thing to think about, is Voldemort just being like, oh, this really stinks.
I know. Like, well, everyone's just got to be quiet back here. Can't say anything. The ruler of all darkness. I'm just stuck in the back of this guy's head under a turban.
Yeah, just absolutely no sympathy for old Voldemort over there.
Also, the next day, I always think this is just funny, where they're eating breakfast and what have we got today? Harry asked Ron as he poured sugar on his porridge. And I'm like, Harry, you're at magic school. Why are you eating porridge? Come on, man. There has got to be better options than porridge.
Than porridge. Like, yeah, but
which,
like,
can't even be that good. You're like dumping sugar on it. Like, even you were like, yeah, it's only okay.
Right. It's like, I feel like throughout the future of all of wizarding meals,
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Like, occasionally.
Maybe Harry just likes plain food.
Plain food.
He's just like, I want baked potatoes and porridge.
Yeah. Just I'll take them together even. Mm-hmm.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pair Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pair Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped because I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This was something I never really super considered before, but the double potions with the Slytherins, this was like one of those things. I've always interpreted double potions or any double class as like back-to-back lessons, but I don't know whether or not like they've had classes with anybody else so far. So it was like, it's like this could be interpreted as double potions means you're taking a class with another house at the same time.
I think that is what it means, but they never describe it as like double care of magical creatures with the Slytherins.
Yeah, that's true. You know? Like it does seem like potions is the one they always have double of, but then I think they're supposed to be taking herbology like 3 days a week.
Yeah, and so, I know in at least their second year they have herbology with the Hufflepuffs.
Right, so is that double herbology?
Is that double herbology? Or yeah, does double mean that the class is back to back? Which would almost make sense for potions because you think maybe you need like a longer time to brew the potion or something.
Well, like in college, yeah. Like I like took, you know, like geology for example because I just needed the science. But, you know, it was like one of those things where I would have like the practical where you would go in and they would like teach you about the rocks and minerals and such like that. And then you would have the lab afterwards. So class was like 3 hours long because you'd spend the first hour and a half learning and the second hour and a half like doing whatever.
Doing the lab. Yeah.
So
I don't know. I don't know whether it means potions class is just two classes back to back or if it just means that you're having class with the second house. But either way, we know they constantly have or at least potions with the Slytherins and care of magical creatures with the Slytherins.
Yes.
And it seems like I think they have Herbology with the Hufflepuffs. I don't think there is a single case where we see the Gryffindors having class with the Ravenclaws ever.
Ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we know the fewest Ravenclaws, I think, of any other house as we learn more about, you know, the other students in Harry's year and stuff. So that is very interesting. Real quick there, we do get the letter from Hagrid inviting Harry down to have tea after his first week. This is something that makes Harry happy, though, because he is then, of course, heading to his least favorite class, where basically right away we get the line, Harry says, at the start of term banquet, Harry had gotten the idea that Professor Snape disliked him. By the end of the first potions lesson, he knew he'd been wrong. Snape didn't dislike Harry. He hated him.
Fact. Yes.
Straight fact.
Yeah.
Snape basically goes on the offensive right away.
Yeah.
Like this, I mean, it's like the least professional thing he could possibly do.
It really is.
You know, it's like, I mean, it has to be the case. And, you know, it's like, I'm sure if you talk to any teacher, I guarantee that there are students in every class where it's just like, it would make my life a lot easier if you were just simply not in this class, you know, because it's always trouble. It's always something. But like, I still don't think that they are like unnecessary. Like, it is still not okay to be unfairly difficult on those students. You know, it's like they are still just students, that you still have to treat them.
Well, at this point, he hasn't done anything either.
I know. Yeah. So he's just like, just right away, he's just super, super mean.
Yeah.
There is, you do sort of get like a little bit of an idea that despite the fact that he always seems to covet the Defense Against the Dark Arts position, that he does have a deep passion for potions in the way that he describes like the subtle science and exact art of potion making.
Yeah. So he's talking about like what you can learn in this class. And he says, I can teach you how to bottle fame, brew glory, and even put a stopper on death. And I was like trying to think if those things actually came to pass at any point.
I mean, brew glory could be Felix Felicis.
That is what I wrote. Is that Felix Felicis? And then I can teach you how to bottle fame. I wrote like Polyjuice potion next to that because they literally all transform into Harry, who is famous at one point. Like, you've sort of bottled fame in that way. I don't know if that counts.
Yeah, but like, otherwise you would think that this would largely be, like, if it was just a potion that simply made you famous somehow, a la Genie making Aladdin a prince, you know? Like,
right, yeah.
It seemed like, you know, if you took it and all of a sudden it's just like there's an entire wealth of knowledge about you as a person and all of your accolades and you are, like, a well-known person because you drank this potion. It's like, I don't know how that would work. It seems like Gilderoy Lockhart, absolutely, it would have been, like, an easier path to success to just brew a whole bunch of...
But exactly what you just said, if you could just turn into a person who everyone knew about, that would be like taking Polyjuice potion and just doing that with someone.
That's true.
Everyone already knew about.
Yes, that's a very good point. That is a very good point.
Which, I mean, does come up. And then even Stopper Death, I just wrote down like Bezor, which he does literally teach them by the end of this page.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I know,
yes,
and so Harry does use it.
Yeah, so the Bezor is kind of an interesting one because we do know that, like, fast forward to year six, Harry will learn from Snape again, the Half-Blood Prince, that, like, the ultimate antidote for most things is just simply shoving a Bezor down their throat, and it will pretty much... It's maybe not, like, a perfect cure-all, but, like in most cases, it will work.
I know. I think there's a funny moment there where I think... because Harry pulls out the Bezor in class and, like... You know, Slughorn is like, 10 points for sheer cheek, you know, or whatever.
Yes.
And, Hermione's all mad because Harry learned about it from the book. And she's like, you could have learned about it in our first year if you'd been listening to Professor Snape. And it's like, he still learned it from Professor Snape in the end.
He did still learn it from that is such a good point. That is such a good point. Interestingly, with the Bezor, you and I have held one before.
A real one. Yeah, Bezors are real things. Not like they won't magically... Well, no, they don't, like, cure you from poison.
No, but I think that they are from the stomach of a goat.
They are from the stomach of a goat, and I think the actual use in the wizarding world was the believed use of them in the real world at one point.
Yeah. So this is not, like, necessarily invented. This is, like, more based on, like, kind of like some historical magic, I guess.
Yeah.
Or proposed magic, rather. The other really kind of interesting one here, and I've seen a lot of speculation about this line, although I think that it's maybe not as, like, grounded, but I sort of love it, either way, if this was the intention. But so Snape says, what would I get if I added powdered root of asphodel to an infusion of wormwood?
Mm-hmm.
Asphodel is a kind of lily.
Oh.
And it means remembrance, and supposedly wormwood is associated with regret. And basically it's like, essentially what Snape could be asking or saying here in code to Harry is effectively like, I regret the loss of your mother, Lily.
Oh, like, right.
So it's like deeply coded, and Harry would never have any way of like determining this.
Well, possibly he could, I guess, because the thing you would actually make if you mix them together is the draft of living death.
Yes.
Which is also then could be a reference to Lily, I guess, although it's not, the draft of living death doesn't kill you, it just puts you into a sleep. But interestingly, for this like comparison, in Harry's sixth year for his first class with Slughorn, when they're competing to win the Felix Felicis, yes, what they're supposed to brew is the draft of living death.
Yes.
Which is so interesting that it comes, it's the very first thing he's asked about, and then it's the one that Harry brews correctly to win the Felix Felicis. Although I went and read that chapter again as well after this, and surprisingly, even though it talks about roots, it talks about like Harry and like Ron chopping up the roots at the beginning, those are Valerian roots. So part of the draft of living death includes chopped Valerian roots, powdered root of Asphodel, and an infusion of wormwood. Like, these two ingredients don't come up in book six, even though they're both mentioned right here.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's like he's only giving you about half the ingredients here.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that is definitely pretty fascinating as well. And yeah, I do love the fact though that like a lot of this stuff does end up ultimately, you know, coming back, as the story continues as well.
That's also, this is another just random thing. It's like Hermione like immediately puts her hand in the air because she knows the answer to the question. But it's like, it's confusing to me that even Hermione knows the answer to the question. Like, what would you do here? Because we know that the draft of living death is a newt or an NEWT level potion. So like, why would there have been any information about it at all in the year one books she got?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. 1,000 magical herbs and fungi.
And fungi. Yeah.
Yeah. Which interestingly seems like it would be the herbology book.
It does.
Not the potions book. But I guess maybe this is like one of those areas where it's like herbology is quite literally growing the ingredients that could be.
It does seem used. There's probably a lot of crossover. Like certainly. when you're learning about historical events in English, because it helps you understand the book rather than learning about those historical events in history.
Precisely. Yeah. That's a really good example. The other thing that happens here is that basically, you know, Harry does sort of snap back at Snape a little bit here. And he said, you know, he basically like, you know, he's being grilled with all these questions very unfairly, to which Harry says, "I don't know," said Harry quietly. "I think Hermione does though. Why don't you try her?" Which is completely like reasonable, you know, from Harry's perspective. He's like, "I don't know what's going on or why you're picking on me, but someone's raising their hand."
Right.
I do think it's interesting that Snape says, "In a point will be taken from Gryffindor House for your cheek powder."
Oh, the point scaling is like, yeah, the point power creep or whatever.
The point power creep is really interesting, but I actually feel like there's a reasonable explanation, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it. But sometimes it occurs to me that like, as year one students, you're more likely to make mistakes or not know answers.
Oh.
And because everything is like a lower level, I almost am curious like if as a first year student, it's like typical like point gains and losses might be smaller because the associated victories and losses are also smaller.
Right, like the amount of knowledge needed to have mastered to earn points as a first year isn't as great as seventh year. So seventh year points are like weighted heavier.
Exactly, yeah.
I do like that explanation. Although I guess you can still lose points for certain out of boundsness because they go on to lose like 50 points apiece later on.
Yes. And I mean, that's the type of thing that I think would probably, especially if you were like a first year, you know, a freshman in the school and like your upperclassman, like, I mean, that would be in and of itself reason to stay in bounds, because losing 50 points as a first year, it's like, you're not even supposed to be able to do that. Like,
right.
You're not even in the zip code of losing 50 points. You
right.
should be losing a point. Or gaining a point.
Yeah, at a time.
Yeah, at a time. Yeah. Like, it feels much more incremental. So that's sort of like my own personal headcanon as to how and why the point totals seem to go from, it seems like 1 point at a time in these opening chapters, to eventually it seems like almost more of like a 5 to 10
point. Yeah, 5 to 10 points for certain increments. Things.
Yeah.
Moving on, there's another sentence here where it says Harry forced himself to keep looking straight into those cold eyes. And that's like a pretty interesting one, because we know that is that Snape is a Legilimens. And so I was like, is Snape reading his mind right now?
Yeah.
Like, I bet he is.
He probably is. This is actually another one that we've talked about before, and it's kind of deeply upsetting to even consider. But one of the big questions we've always had is that Harry looks exactly like James, except for the eyes. But we've always said, like, what would happen if Harry had been like Lily's double? You know, right. And so like all of a sudden what had showed up, and I mean, Ginny could possibly, I don't know, maybe not really be a good case study for it. But, you know, the question would be like, if Harry showed up and looked, was the spitting image of Lily, would Snape have treated him differently?
Oh man. Yeah. It feels like he would have. Yeah.
It feels like he would have. Yeah. Because he would have been looking at, you know, this person he loved rather than this person he despised.
Right.
You know, because that's always what's weird to me is that it's like, you know, Snape is so mean, but like this person is still part Lily.
Oh, the other thing here is says Harry forced himself to keep looking straight into those cold eyes. The other thing Snape could be doing is looking at Harry's eyes because that's the part of him that looks like Lily.
You're right.
Oh, boy, that's, just gave myself chills. That's
yeah, that is weird.
That does sound...
I think that's more likely.
I think that's more likely.
Than reading his mind in that moment. Yeah.
Yeah, because this is like the first time he would have seen it, like seen Harry's eyes properly.
Oh man,
that's weird.
That is weird.
Okay. Moving on. The next thing he says, or the next thing he reveals, is that Monkshood and Wolfsbane are the same plant. They are, go by the name of Aconite. I feel like in retrospect, this feels like a light, Lupin. Reference
yeah.
as well, because Wolfsbane is part of the Wolfsbane potion, and this is sort of just like an early hint. I guess Snape might not know how much Harry knows about like James and his friends or anything,
sure.
But this is like, it feels like if you're including this to Harry, then it's like, yes, I know about the werewolf kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, especially if the, you know, if you were to make the assertion, and I'd be curious if you could draw anything out from these other questions that he's asking, if he is in some way, shape, or form alluding to each of the founders and Lily. In any way, shape, or form. Like we said, one of the things he's asked about is possibly already a direct reference to the loss of Lily Potter. You know, and if this one here is supposed to be a little reference to Lupin, it's like, does the Bazaar or what else does he have in here? He has a few questions that he kind of like rattles off all at once. It would just be interesting if like somehow they were like
yeah,
that's the Sirius Black reference, or like that's the Peter reference.
That would be interesting. Yeah, man, I don't know. Yeah, I guess we can try and look further into that. But it does seem like at least two of them get referenced right there.
Yes, indeed.
Yep.
As we move forward a little bit, we see that, you know, like Neville obviously right away is starting to sort of struggle under the pressure that comes from Snape's teaching methods.
He just straight up calls him an idiot.
Yeah, I underlined that. I was like,
so uncalled for. Like, it's one thing to hate Harry because he looks like your mortal enemy.
Yeah.
It is another to just bully Neville for no reason.
Oh, I know. Well, I mean, even then, you know, he takes it out on Harry one step further after poor Neville's already been sent to the hospital wing. You, Potter, why didn't you tell him not to add the quills? Thought he'd make you look good if he got it wrong, did you? It's like, Snape, how are you pulling this stuff? Like, I don't even know how you think to be this mean.
I know. It's like, you know, he's just down there teaching the 6 years Hufflepuffs at one point in the air, and he's like, what? What is this? Where's Potter? This is his fault.
You know what? I bet it was Harry. This
has got Potter all over it.
All over it. It's like I was in a different class, sir.
I'm not even in Hufflepuff. Yeah. Oh, so this is not relevant yet, but I always love to imagine what it's like for Snape to have to teach Luna potions.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I just
feel
like it'd be really funny.
No, it would be hilarious to see Luna in Snape's class, because, well, I'd like to think that Luna would just be good at this. You know, like, I mean, she is a Ravenclaw. I mean,
yeah.
she's very intelligent. Like, I like to think that like she'd be the type of person who would just like intuitively know some of like the prince's secrets.
Oh, I know.
I added the sprig of peppermint. It's believed that blah, blah, blah. And it's like,
Like she's getting the right answers for the wrong reasons or something. Yeah,
absolutely. That's so Luna, which I feel like would be that could be like a skit unto itself.
Yeah.
Just like watching Snape be like, that is a good point. I can't fault what you did. It all worked out. As we move forward onto the next page, Ron is trying to cheer up Harry, and we do get another one of those references to Fred and George.
Yep.
Where, speaking of Snape teaching other students, it says Snape's always taking points off of Fred and George, which, you know, is kind of like one of those things. It's just sort of a testament, again, that it's like Fred and George are doing it right. If Snape doesn't like you, it's like that means you're probably...
You got it, yeah, right. Yeah. Doing a good thing there.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Otherwise, Hagrid spent half his life chasing your twin brothers away from the forest. Like, what are they doing in there?
Yep.
Who knows?
This is like one of those things where I have since learned, thanks to the Great British Baking Show, that rock cakes are in fact just a common British like food.
But this I always thought was just sort of like a slam on Hagrid's cooking.
That is what I thought as well. Yeah, but in fact, rock cakes are something that you would commonly find, I think, in like a, you know, like a British environment. But like the fact that it's also paired up with the fact that they're like tooth breaking, you know, it's sort of like, it just sort of seems like what he's effectively doing is serving something that's closer to a rock than a cake.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Like rock cakes are a thing. Hagrid is making rock cakes.
Yes. Yeah. So that's something that forever and ever and ever I would have just I always would have assumed that was like a wizarding thing,
stirring up a completely random memory in my brain from fourth grade there was a class trip we went on to Williamsburg.
Okay.
And I remember that it was like an overnight trip. So this is like the big fourth grade trip you got to go on.
Amazing.
And while you're there, and like, I think mom came and she chaperoned, and you know, I was like so excited to get like souvenirs for, you know, everyone else in the family. I had to, you know, bring them back some like handmade soap or, you know, something like that.
Oh, right.
And I think one of the things were these I think they were called it was like hard rolls or something, but they were just these like, you know, it was exactly what it sounds like. It's like a very just stale piece of bread, I think, or like a really, really hard piece of bread. And I remember thinking like, I'm getting this for dad, obviously, so excited. I was like, this is such a cool thing. Like it's hard on purpose.
He's like, he's going to love
it. He's going to love it. Yeah, no, yeah. Fourth grade me was like, I'm so excited to give this to dad. And I remember like, I can still picture like him at the table, like absolutely doing his best to like seem excited about it and not be able to take a bite of it because it was such like a hard roll.
Rock solid. I don't think I've ever heard that story, but that's hysterical.
It just made me think of it. And I was like, oh, now I feel so embarrassed. Like I must have misunderstood the roles or something as a child, but I was like, I understand this completely and it's so cool.
Well, I love that mom was just like completely, she was there and she was like, do it. She's like, I cannot wait to see your dad's face when you present him with a rock hard roll. Anyway, well, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Good to know that we've all been there. Yep. Let's see. Going forward, we hear Hagrid talking a little bit about Mrs. Norris.
I know.
There's sort of like an interesting line that I was kind of curious as to like whether or not you could pull a string on, or if we ever have in the past, if anything tickles your thoughts there. But one of the things that we learn is Hagrid says, as for the cat, Mrs. Norris, I'd like to introduce her to Fang sometime. Do you know every time I go up to the school, she follows me everywhere. Can't get rid of her. Filch puts her up to it, I think. And this is like one of those where it's like, why would Mrs. Norris follow Hagrid everywhere?
Right? Yeah, I don't know.
Like this is because like that. It almost feels like that must mean something suspicious,
yeah,
like or perceived suspicious about Hagrid. Like I don't really like Filch or Mrs. Norris, but like, and for that matter, I love Hagrid, but I can't really figure out like why that would happen. Like,
well, I guess the Hagrid is assumed to have opened the Chamber of Secrets.
True.
Like the teachers, I guess, would know that, like why he was expelled. So I suppose Filch could just be like openly
like perceiving his presence at the school as like a like an attack on the rules of the school, maybe.
Sure.
Like, I mean, he should have been expelled and like gone for that instead of like immediately being hired on as like an employee with keys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Boy, Dumbledore's hiring of Hagrid. Just, I mean, I love Hagrid, and clearly Dumbledore is right about it. But like, what he must have said to Armando Dippet? It's like, oh yeah, moaning Myrtle. Myrtle Warren's dead, and we're pretty much the best student ever. You know, Tom Riddle. He found the murderer. Yeah,
yeah.
He found it's Hagrid. We found the monster. It's definitely him. Hear me out. We hire him, and I know he murdered someone, but what if we give him...
Allegedly
give him keys to every door in the castle? Just, we'll call him the keeper of the keys.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Yeah, it's a safe role.
It's a safe role for this possible murderer.
Yeah. I don't know how he was able to successfully pull that off. It seems like it must have been a pretty great challenge. But
yeah.
But either way, we know that Dumbledore was right and Hagrid is kind-hearted and Mrs. Norris has got nothing to go off of here.
Nothing
whatsoever. As we move down a little bit, we get a reference to Ron's brother Charlie.
Oh yeah,
which is kind of interesting because I feel like he he's largely brought up more in the first book. And then for the most part, it feels like Bill sort of takes over as like chief oldest brother.
Yeah, you know, no doubt.
For the rest of the story. So we get a little bit more Goblet. We do get a little bit of Charlie. But really, I feel like we spend more time with Bill. But maybe it's just because when you get to the end of the series, you've just spent more time with Bill.
Well, Charlie's not in the movies at all either. Like no, Bill is in the movies, but Charlie isn't.
Right.
Which is like a why not kind of thing.
Yeah, I have no idea. Kind of an unusual one.
Yeah.
So that's sort of interesting.
There's also this sort of weird thing where that keeps like sort of alluding to the fact that Hagrid knows something about why Snape doesn't like Harry. And it's like, I don't think Hagrid does know why Snape doesn't like Harry. Does he?
At the very least, Hagrid would have probably known. Hagrid would have been there as a school staffer while both Snape and James attended.
True.
So I think it's very possible that what Hagrid is not telling Harry is the history between James and and Snape. That would be like my
I guess bet. So. Yeah. I guess that's about as much as he can know.
Because if you were Hagrid and like witnessed all that and you had a closer relationship with James, but you also kind of James is a jerk in high school. So
yeah,
like,
I guess at this point, yeah, Hagrid's been like nicer people you couldn't have found, except for Snape.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that would probably be my best bet is that Hagrid doesn't know the full story, but he knows just enough to know like. You're probably fighting an uphill battle in that one. Mm-hmm. And I don't really want to like sully, you know, your dead father's name, you know, by telling you like, by the way, your dad was kind of a jerk to him. So like, you know, he doesn't have a lot of ground to stand on, but like probably more than none.
More than none, specifically against your dad.
Right. As we chuck forward though, we learn more about the Gringotts break-in, which of course happened the same day that Harry and Hagrid were at Gringotts Bank. One of my just favorite things is at the end of this like little news clipping that Hagrid has is just that they specifically refer to the person who gave the account of what happened as a spokesgoblin.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like not a spokesman, a spokesgoblin. Yeah, get it right. I think that's pretty fun and clever. This is sort of interesting because it's like the first piece of, you know, like the puzzle a little bit to where like they're starting to realize like, wait a second, I was there that day. Hagrid handled that package. Like,
right.
They're starting to get like,
we emptied a vault.
Right. Like, you know, this is where like, you know, Harry kind of becomes a little bit of like Encyclopedia Brown.
Yeah. He starts being Detective Harry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Starting to try to like pull the pieces of the overall like story together.
Yeah.
Let's see. And that's pretty much,
that's mostly what happens for chapter 8.
Yes. Yeah.
The potions master.
It's a fun chapter overall. I mean, you know, I think Harry just sort of like attending school as usual, like experiencing the wizarding world. I often say that I feel like, you know, Goblet of Fire, I think has always historically been one of my favorite books in the saga. And I think a huge reason for that is because it's still like Harry is still like being immersed more and more in the wizarding world. Like he's still being exposed to like brand new things for the first time. And I feel like that largely continues all the way from books 1 through 4. And then like once he's up to like year 5, it's almost like Harry's pretty well acclimated to the wizarding world. Like, you know, it's you're having less of like this like awestruck looking around like, wow, this place is amazing and magic is so cool. Like,
right.
You know, it's like at that point in time, it's more like, okay, he's in it now. Like
yeah,
he's a pretty seasoned wizard. So, you know, I feel like this is just like one of those good chapters where you're just sort of like seeing Harry do school, enjoy school. Hogwarts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though it kind of sounds like all of his teachers kind of suck.
I know. Who was a good teacher here? Flitwick, Sprout, McGonagall. Sounds about right.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
As we go. Everything would press forward.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that'll round us off for chapter 8. What do you think about the chapter art here?
Okay, I actually had thoughts about the chapter art on this one because it's called the Potions Master. We don't spend like a specific... It's almost like the fact that this is a chapter where it's called the Potions Master, but not like... And you do spend the most amount of time in Snape's class, but you could have just called it like week one. And the fact that it's called the Potion Master like helps draw your attention specifically to the interaction with Snape and that he's important. But the artwork itself is just a spell book and it's called the Potions Master. So it was like, part of me is like wondering, like, is the spell book in question up there? Like the copy of Advanced Potion Making or something? Like, is it like, it's called the Potions Master picture of book. Like, is this like, it doesn't have any, it's not a picture of Snape, you know?
That's a
why
good
isn't
point.
It a picture of Snape
or a cauldron
or a cauldron or anything to do with potions? It's like it must be a potions book, but there is a very specific potions book that is really important to the whole story. So I don't. It doesn't feel like the sort of information that would have been given out after book one. Like, oh yeah, make this a book because the sixth book's going to be about a book. You know?
Right. But, yeah, like which represent you know which is the Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. So it's hard to know whether or not there would be like that much forethought, but. It seems like a strange choice.
Yeah.
But the other thing too, and probably to your point, is that like you're attempting to really start shining the spotlight on Snape at this point in the story. Like, because what we know is that he's going to be the red herring for the whole freaking story.
Yeah.
Like we are pretty much suspecting Snape as like, you know, person number one.
Person number one.
Suspect number one.
The whole time. Yeah. I mean, even... Like, I mean, Harry outright says, like, why did Snape hate him so much? And I literally wrote the note, like, yeah, only seven books to go.
Oh, I know. Yeah, that's the other thing, too, is, yeah. And I wrote this on the last page. I just said, like, this, we get the introduction to the mystery, like, why does Snape hate Harry? So, like, a lot of these mysteries, I do remember experiencing them for the first time and just desperately wanting the answer. Because at this point in the story, you do not have enough information to go off of to be able to, like, be like, Snape was in love with Harry's mother. Like, it's yeah. like, there's no way you could have ever deduced that out at this stage. So yeah, that's, I do think that, you know, it's really the ignition point for what will go on to be a seven book long mystery.
Yeah. So there's that. I've also got a review.
Oh, hey. Okay. Let's read it.
All right. This is from Pottergirl13.
It
says, I didn't know I needed this podcast. I love this so much. I found out I'm pregnant with my first little before this released. It's so crazy to think about where I'll be when all of this is over. I'll have an almost 4-year-old, maybe even more. Anyways, you guys have really helped me keep things off my mind with this and your YouTube channel. Thank you for all you do. Can't wait to see where this goes and what will come.
Oh, that's so cool. It's actually really fun because literally as of recording today's episode is actually my daughter Addison's second birthday.
Well, happy birthday, Addison.
I know, happy birthday, Addie. Because I have had a similar thought before. Like when we started like slating this all out and we realized like, you know, if we're doing a chapter a week and how many chapters do we have, it's like this is gonna take a while.
Yeah.
You know, to get all the way through the whole saga and everything. So we have lots of runway left ahead of us, but it will be so fascinating to see like where everybody's lives are at, you know, by the time we get to the end of it.
I know.
It's gonna be
and it's so yeah, it's like roughly 4 years from now. So like, how old will my kids be? Like 9, 10 for Luke? Like,
oh man,
that's crazy to think about.
That is wild. That is absolutely wild, but also very exciting.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, I can't have a 9-year-old. Are you crazy? It feels like he was just born.
It does feel that way. But anyway, guys, that is chapter 8 for you from Philosopher's Stone. If you would like to leave us a review, we would greatly appreciate it. It certainly helps, you know, with the discoverability of the podcast as it exists out there in the pod sphere. Plus, there's a good opportunity for us to potentially read it here in one of the future episodes.
So absolutely.
Be sure to go and leave a 5-star and a review. But I think that's all for today.
Yeah. Otherwise, join us next time through the Gryffindor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.